Support for WBFO and What's Next comes from our members and from Health Foundation for Western and Central New York, where racial and socioeconomic health equity are prioritized. Learn more about building healthier neighborhoods at hfwcny.org.
From Buffalo, Toronto Public Media, this is What's Next, an hour dedicated to amplifying the voices of marginalized and underrepresented communities across Western New York and Southern Ontario.
We cannot erase, we cannot reform, we cannot make things better if we're uncomfortable having tough conversations,
Absolutely.
If we're uncomfortable
Absolutely.
Talking about race.
What's Next carries forward our mission to engage in meaningful conversations about race, equity, and the shared concerns that deeply affect Buffalo's East Side and beyond.
Don't stop. Make those families part of your life. Their lives are part of yours. Don't stop.
Together, we dive into the real issues, striving for understanding, connection, and change.
In the suburban area, everywhere, we must work and teach our children.
On this segment of What's Next, we're going to talk with Justin Hawkins. Justin has developed an interesting approach to teaching financial literacy.
Yes.
It's called Street Credit.
Yes, yes it is.
Justin, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me. It's an honor.
So what prompted you to start this?
Oh, man. You want to know the beginning? It's actually crazy. So I was just doing my thing. I'm a barber. I already make six figures. I cut for the Buffalo Bills. I cut the players, the coaches. And on Sundays, we go cut the fans and everything. Have you ever seen
it's with the signature cuts.
Yeah,
right?
With signature cuts. Yeah. Yep. So if you ever seen the kids with the Buffalo Bills logo on the side of their head.
See them all the time. Yeah.
So I created that apparatus to do that.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I created that. But so I'm just doing my thing and living life and trying to find ways to navigate and started buying houses and stuff. And as I'm doing stuff, I'm just leaving little breadcrumbs on social media. So one day, auntie number 15 called me. So I call her auntie 15 because my wife, she always introduces me. Every week I'm meeting a new auntie. So this auntie number 15, she calls me randomly and she's like, hey, God told me that you should start a credit course. I was like, you know, I kind of felt it, but I'm like, I'm not sweating that. Kept doing what I was doing. I own vending machines. I'm a landlord. I got all this stuff going on. I'm not thinking about that, right? So 3 days before I get married, all my credit cards were shut off.
Whoa.
All my credit cards were shut off. So I looked to my wife, like, all right, maybe you can hold us, keep us afloat for in the meantime until I figure this thing out. Her credit score was terrible. She had a 580. She had six recent late payments. She had the collections I didn't know about. So I'm like, what in the world? So now I'm like, what are you doing? I'm the credit guy and your credit is terrible. What are you doing? You know she did, right? She blamed me.
That's kind of, I've married, you know, so I guess, right? I understand that.
Yeah, so she blamed me. So we get married and then I kind of just locked in. I was like, now I got to figure out my situation and figure out hers. So last year, she started the year off with a 580. Within 3 months, I had her to a 747.
747?
747 in 3 months. So I said, wow. So within 3 months, I got that type of result. The next 3 months, I spent the 3 months writing a book to kind of show people the exact process I used for her credit to fix it. And I didn't remove none of the late payments. I didn't remove none of the collections. I just know how to build credit well.
Okay.
And found a way I could help everybody else do it too. So I created a little course to put together. But that's how I got here. Really just, I feel like God forced me into the, because I got that call. I kind of ignored it. And God was like, all right, you don't want to pay attention to me? All right, I'm gonna find a way.
Yep. So, let's go through that in a little bit, if you don't mind. We're talking about building your wife's credit. So you said that you did it in 3 months. That I think that's worth noting, obviously.
Right.
So, what were some of the things that you did?
So, first, what I did was my credit is really good. So I put her under as an authorized user on one of my credit cards. It's probably like a $10,000 credit card. So that helped her with her utilization. At the time, she had two credit cards that was maxed out.
Okay.
So, but they were smaller credit cards, probably $2,000 to $2,000. Once I put her under my $10,000 credit card, that shot her stuff down. And I took over her credit, to be honest. Got all her passwords. You can't use this no more. I paid off the children's place. You know, they love to buy stuff for the kids. I paid off the children's place and cut it up. Paid off the Victoria's Secret card and cut it up. put her under as an authorized user. I got her another credit card, a fresh credit card. You can't use this one. Then we went and got loans. So a lot of misconceptions is people get loans when they need it.
Right.
That's not actually the best way to build credit. You get loans and use them you don't have credit use you, you use credit.
So what, you're talking about getting personal loans.
Personal loans. Okay. So first we started with a secure loan. And with a secure loan, it's kind of like a savings account. You pay into it. Say if it's a $500 secure loan, that's what I did with her. You pay them, pay into it. And then once you paid off, then they give you $500 back. But the whole purpose of that is to build credit.
Sure. Okay.
So
did you do it through your bank, through a credit union? How'd you do it?
Credit union. Good Neighbors Credit Union. And it was simple. Just asked them, hey, could we do a credit builder account? She signed up. We did. I already had like a car under them.
Okay.
So they was familiar with me. And we did it that way. That was a 6-month one. We paid that off. And then we went ahead and did a unsecured one for $1,200. Now, the sneaky thing you could do is, like I said, we didn't actually need the money. We just needed to build our credit. So if you go get a personal loan for $1,200, they hand you $1,200. We use the same $1,200 to pay them back with.
Gotcha.
Because we don't actually need the money. We just want to build the credit.
Yeah.
So small stuff like that. I got her two. So the recap, I got her two credit cards. I got her two loans. That's the bare minimum you need. At all times, you need 4 accounts reporting. A lot of people don't know that.
4, okay.
4 accounts reporting. At least 2 got to be loans. At least 2 got to be credit cards. So we just took that approach, and that's what I basically came up with in my course. I'm just getting people the bare minimum, 2 cards and 2 loans, and that get them a jump start way better than what they ever knew.
So your suggestion then is first not to be in a situation like your wife, which is a situation that millions of Americans are in, right? We know that for sure. But you're suggesting that before you get into that situation, build your credit before you have to make those payments, right?
You got it. So the best time to build credit is when you don't actually need credit. So when you actually need it, it's already there. So if somebody unexpectedly smack your car and total it, now you got to go to the dealership and you're trying to call somebody that do credit repair to be a musician. Hey, I need everything removed by 3:00 today. Like, what? How is that even possible? So the best time to build credit is when you don't need it.
Gotcha. Yeah. Gotcha. So you've obviously been talking with your wife. So who else have you been talking with?
Everybody.
Yeah.
Everybody. So I feel like it was an untapped market. Nobody, especially in Buffalo, really talks about credit. So once I got into it, my inbox is flooded. At least hundreds of people. Mostly people my age, around my age. When you get around 30, you start to care about credit. You start to realize how important it really is. You start in your family. You want to go get your first house. So mostly people around my age. But what surprised me is the 40, 50, 60-year-olds be contacting me too. And it really caught me off guard. I thought I would be talking to maybe 18 to 24.
Right.
And it's actually, I realized the problem is much bigger than I could ever imagine.
And the people that you're talking to are the situations, the problems, are they all kind of similar?
Very similar.
Yeah?
Very similar. Very similar. So a lot of times our community, we afraid of credit. So a lot of people say, I'm just not going to deal with credit cards at all, and think that's something they can brag about. Well, actually, if you don't have a credit card at all, you automatically lose 165 points because you don't have utilization. So the second you get one credit card, your utilization shoots up 100 points.
Okay.
Like within the first month.
Okay.
So stuff like that, stuff like people, they 35 and only had 3-4 accounts their entire life. You need at least a minimum of 10 to even be considered fair credit.
Right.
So little stuff like that. A lot of people either have no credit cards. A lot of people don't have enough accounts reporting. A lot of people don't do nothing with credit at all. So the people with no credit at all is really the easiest to help because they don't have no bad habits to get over.
Stay with us. There's more to come. This is What's Next on WBFO.
Shut up. You're listening to The Five Satins with In the Still of the Night, an Embassy 78 from 1956, and you're on the Soundbeat. Nighttime is often the right time for thoughtful reflection, especially when one is on guard duty in the Army. Such is the case with this song, written by Fred Parris while on active duty. He and the Satins recorded it in the basement of the St. Bernadette Church in their hometown of New Haven, Connecticut. It was a big hit, but Paris didn't get to celebrate long. He would be called back to active duty shortly after the release. Just how big a hit was it? It's the only song to have made the Billboard Top 100 three times. That's the same artist with the same version. It debuted at number 24 in 1956, was released again in 1960, reaching number 81, and then a year later it reached number 99. It's also talked about as the origins of doo-wop. Find out more now at soundbeat.org. Soundbeat is produced at the Belfer Audio Archive, Syracuse University Libraries. I'm Brett Barry.
Did you know that WNED PBS is always working on great new local shows for you to watch? Documentaries like Kleinhand's Gift to Buffalo, which tells the story of Buffalo's Music Hall.
The hall is very intimate, and that intimacy makes everyone who comes in here feel a part of our family.
Fun and educational series like Compact Science.
Believe it or not, peppers are technically fruits.
And Shakespeare's greatest hits featuring some of his best-known soliloquies and monologues.
We are such stuff as dreams are made of.
You can watch them all on our website at wned.org/local shows. While you're there, check out the show pages and mini websites for additional content such as bonus features, photo galleries, and lesson plans. Find it all at wned.org/local shows.
This is Jack Cruiser with the scoreboard on WBFO. Listen during Morning Edition and All Things Considered each Monday, Wednesday, and Friday for the latest on pro matchups and college rivalries, as well as standout local athletes from Western New York and Southern Ontario. Want more? Listen to a longer version of the scoreboard at WBFO.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to What's Next, our place to discuss the important issues of our communities of Western New York and Southern Ontario. We want to hear from you. Click on the Talk to Us option in the WBFO app, and we will work to get your questions or comments on the air. Have a story or concern that we should be addressing? Email us using whatsnext@wbfo.org. Together, we'll have the conversations that are needed. This is WBFO, your NPR station.
And so when it comes to some of the older folks that you're talking to, again, like you said, there's a lot of commonalities there, but it's interesting to hear that, you know, there may be people who are maybe my age who are struggling with their credit situations. Mm-hmm. I mean, what do you attribute that to, that somebody could go through that portion of life and find themselves in that situation?
Fear. Our community around credit is just all fear. Even growing up, I was never taught credit. It was never talked about, but like hearing little arguments with my parents and about the credit card bill and everything, I even had fear of it. I never wanted to do anything with it until I was kind of forced into it. I was forced into credit, not forced into it, but it intrigued me later on. I found somebody named Him500, and the way he was just talking about credit was just so crazy to me. He was saying how you could use your credit cards to make money by adding people as authorized users, how you could go buy cars and stuff and buy assets and allow the assets to pay off the credit cards. And it was like, wow, I never heard credit in this way.
Right.
And it got me intrigued in it. And I really got a head start on everybody in my generation because they don't start thinking about credit until later on.
So you use the word fear, and I can remember when my credit cards were maxed out, sweating in the middle of the night,
exactly,
like nightmares. But at the same time, also, like you said, in your community, you find that people have a lot of fear.
Mm-hmm.
Is that fear justified in some cases? Are we seeing people being, people being repossessed,
right,
evicted, things along those lines?
So I've seen my mom's car get repossessed as well. The fear is justified, but it's only because of lack of knowledge. We fear everything we don't really understand. We fear taxes when taxes is not nothing to actually fear once you understand them. Credit is not nothing to fear once you actually understand it. You know what I'm saying? So it is justified, but maxing out credit cards, that's just bad spending habits. You
right,
know what I'm saying?
Right.
So once you really understand what to do and how to do it and get strategic, and I actually do something called Strategic Sundays and really show people how to be strategic about credit. And like I said, it's not just use credit when you need it. Have an actual plan. If you're going to get a car, you don't go get a car next week. You be strategic. 6 months plan, hey, I'm going to do this, and that. The month before, I'm going to pay down my utilization so my score goes up. So now when I go in, I have a better score. I get a better interest rate. So we need more strategy around credit instead of fear and just being impulse buyers.
We're talking with Justin Hawkins this morning from Street Credit. Justin is helping lots of people with their credit situation. Also, we should note that Justin, if you go to see Signature Cuts, he goes under the name Juju at Signature Cuts if you want to get your hair done. But, you know, the nice thing, of course, like you said, you found in the barbering business a nice cash flow for yourself, which was great, and it was very helpful.
For sure.
Other people, though, as you know, people who are in your community, young people in general, struggle sometimes to find jobs that really have decent paying jobs.
Yeah.
Can what you're doing here with Street Credit, can you help out somebody who's making minimum wage?
Oh, yeah, for sure. So credit isn't even about money, to be honest. So like I said, you could go get a $200 secure card, a secure loan, not even a secure card. You get a $200 secure card. You get a $200 secure loan. Maybe that payment is $15 a month. Once you paid off, they give you all the money back. I would suggest somebody just keep doing those over and over. Keep doing those over and over because it builds up your payment history. You have an amazing score, and all you're doing is recycling $200 loan. So it's not even about money. And what I would suggest people to do, like I said, you need a minimum of two loans and two credit cards. Everybody has Netflix. Everybody has Apple Music. Get one credit card, put your Netflix subscription on this credit card, put your Apple Music subscription on this credit card, put on auto pay. Those little $30 payments is keeping your, those $30 subscription is keeping your card active so they're not going to shut it down. And then it's auto pay. So it's keeping your utilization low, which is 30% of your score. It's keeping your card active. Your score is going to shoot up. So,
and plus, you're going to be able to keep track of those subscriptions in one place instead of chasing them all over the place.
So, you got to use credit. Don't let credit use you. So it doesn't take a lot of money at all, actually.
So let's talk about how you go about, you know, teaching these lessons through Street Credit. You know, what are the possibilities for somebody who wants to know more?
Oh, man, the possibilities are endless. So what I like to say is, if you understand the basics, if you want to finesse any system, you got to really understand the system at its core, the rules and regulations, and then you kind of manipulate it to work in your favor. So the possibilities are endless. As much as you, as your creativity work, you can make anything happen. And that's kind of what I do. I think of it like if you cooking. So if you go to school, they'll teach you how to cook the chicken correctly. It got to be cooked at this temperature and you don't cook it with the fish. You know what I'm saying? You wash it a certain way. And then however you season it, that's up to you. So I try to teach people to learn the basics and then get as creative as you want with it. So you can go get houses. I bought a business car. I bought a car under my business name. I only had my LLC for 3 months. I bought my first duplex with credit. I didn't have a job or a LLC at the time. My second duplex, I bought on a credit card. I use a credit card. Yep. So it's stuff like that. And
the interest rate wasn't too high?
It was zero. It was 0% interest. So
for a limited time.
For a limited time. So like I said, everything I'm strategic with. So I go get the credit card, 0% interest for 16 months. I literally just paid it off today, Jay, before I came
Congratulations.
Here.
Congratulations.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you. So, you know, stuff like that. You could be very strategic once you know the basis. So, yeah, I got it. Once your credit is good enough, you could get 0% interest for the first 12 months, first 15 months, the first 20 months. If you know where to go, you know what cars to look for. You know, so everything I do is very strategic.
So what are you hearing now from the people that you've worked with and through Street Credit? What are, you know, give me some, besides your wife,
Your
success stories.
You know what? This one specifically, I like because it shows. So a lot of people, they take my help and then they go do their own thing. I really feel like they should be more attached to me and contact me before. So this specific person, I helped them with their credit. When they came to me, the highest credit card limit was $500. After about 3 months, They applied for Chase and they got a credit card and the limit was $2,500.
Okay.
So you would think, oh, that's great. That's five times higher than what they came to me as, right? But what they didn't know is if you go to Chase and you get a Sapphire card for that just because with the same credit profile, a Sapphire card starts with a higher bottom limit. So I said, oh, that's great. But if you would apply for this card, you would have got more. So same day I had her apply for that same card,
mm-hmm.
she got approved for $6,000. Same credit profile, everything. Wow. So within one day, she got approved for $8,500 in credit cards. So it just showed the nuances of things. Just knowing which credit card to go with can make a big difference, and being attached to somebody that actually understands this stuff. But I get all types of stuff like, hey, Juju, you really helped me get my apartment. Hey, Juju, I got that card. I got that vehicle, and my score is still going up. Thank you so much. I'm sending so many people to you. Every day my inbox is full. So many people recommended me to come to you, and I hear everything.
Yeah. Now, yeah. So I appreciate how you're talking about being strategic and how you utilize your credit
yeah.
to help. I mean, in essence, not only help build your credit score and
yep.
and make capital available, but also mm. you know, perhaps maybe to, like you said, purchase a business-owned car or
yep.
or get into a duplex situation. But at the same time, what about, you know, everybody has their spending habits, right?
Right, right.
What are you telling people to, hey, stay away from when it comes to spending?
You know what? I kind of just started to develop this mindset because honestly, people going to do what they want to do.
Right.
But now I developed a 60-20-20 rule. 60% of your budget goes towards your necessities. That's your car. That's your living. That's your food. 20% goes towards fun, activities, whatever you want to do and enjoy yourself. And 20%, dang, what was the other 20%?
Save? Saving?
Save. There it goes. Save, save investment, stocks,
right.
you know, stuff for the future, like for emergencies and stuff.
Right.
So that's what I just developed. That's actually what I just taught some kids. I was at, Buffalo Urban League. I was at Buffalo Urban League about 2 weeks ago, and we developed that course for kids. They're about to graduate from high school and really enter into the real world. And we wanted to give them that mindset before they go out here and get their apartments or get their cars or, you know, do whatever they're about to do. I wanted them to have a budget to have in mind whenever they make money.
Now, let's go back a little bit into your personal story. Let's go back maybe
yeah.
Justin Hawkins going to college, getting out of high school.
Yeah.
What kind of a spender, saver, investor were you then? Were you credit smart back then?
I wasn't credit smart. I was definitely credit ignorant, but I was always a great saver. I was a great saver, and I actually had good credit, but I wouldn't say I was credit smart. So my dad always kind of like had the mentality of if you owe somebody, pay them. That works for credit. That automatically works for credit. So the second, you know, if my payment due, I'm paying it. You know, just on-time payments is 35% of your score. So I always had good credit. I never had bad credit.
Okay.
But I was always a saver. I just always, when I wanted something, I wanted to have the money to have it. So
yeah.
That's just how I always was. Coming out of high school, I was a saver. Even when I wasn't making much, I still had money. I had money put aside. So that's just how I naturally was.
Yeah. Did you have, and you were okay with your credit cards early on? You didn't max yourself out at any time?
So I really didn't start getting credit cards until I was about 22 and I wanted to get a MacBook laptop, and I went to Best Buy and didn't even realize they gave me a credit card. I was just paying on it. So once I paid all the way off, I never even used it again. If I was credit smart, I would have went to Best Buy every month and at least made a small purchase to keep the card open. But I paid it off and never thought about it, and I let it close. And you actually don't want to let credit cards close, because one of the most valuable things you can have is an aged credit card.
Oh, really?
But yeah, so start at 22. I had great credit on accident, but
okay.
I really feel like what I would say is good credit means nothing if you don't know what to do with it.
Right.
So I had 700 scores all the way up until I was like 26. And didn't actually start really using credit until I was 26 in a strategic way, because I didn't know until I met that one guy that was speaking about it in such a elaborate way, in an interesting way. And that's kind of what I want to do for my community. I want to speak about it in an interesting way that give people like, oh, wow, I didn't know you could do that. You know, give you that type of realization. Like, I didn't know you could do all that with credit.
Yeah. You know, and I appreciate what you say about wanting to do this for your community. I think
yeah.
that's, you know, obviously admirable for sure.
Yeah.
Do you see, are you getting a sense as you're starting to you know, engage people that more and more people want, you know, in the community,
for sure,
want to find a way to make this work for them,
for
like
sure.
you have.
For sure. And I like to be the example. Like I said, so I'm 33 years old. I bought two duplexes in 2 years. I'm not Big Bank Hank. I don't make hundreds of millions of dollars. You know what I'm saying? But I'm just strategic. So people see this and like, you know, I know him. I grew up with him. I played basketball with him. I played football with him. How is he doing this? You know, I don't sell drugs. I never did. What is this guy doing? Now let him know it's credit.
Yeah.
And it's actually simple. If you just, you know, you get the foundation right, you get built on top of it. So people are very interested.
How's life as a landlord?
Life as a landlord has been good, actually. So when I bought my first duplex, I inherited my first tenant. So I bought the house with the tenant in it, and they completely trashed this place. Mm. When they finally left, the boyfriend had wrote all type of slurs on the walls, B and H, you know, because they was doing a lot of arguing. It was crazy. That first experience was really crazy. She got her kids taken by CPS. Mm. Once she moved out, the cops was coming to the house. But after that, I got a tenant with Section 8. I learned a lot about that process, and now all the payments is on time every month. We handpicked the tenant, so she was really good. I officially bought my second duplex at December 23rd of last year. So today, so now I basically have three tenants. So okay. I like the house hack. I house hack. So the way I get low down payments, like I said, I'm strategic. I get low down payments. I get FHA loans, and which is 3.5% down. So my first, but you got to live in a house for a minimum of 1 year. So right. I house hack, bought my first duplex, got the low down payment. Went and got the second one with another low down payment, 5% down payment. So right now I have three tenants.
And you have one of the units yourself.
And I live in one, thank you, yep. Gotcha. And I live in one of the units myself. So today the third tenant will be paying a down payment, and they'll be moving in the first of this month. So this is my first time actually having tenants that's not on Section 8. So it'd be cool to see how they pay down everything.
Right, right. Yeah. It's really exciting that you've explored. So you went to Hutch Tech. So, mm-hmm. I mean, you know, it's one of the more challenging schools in the Buffalo Public School District. So, so you've had no trouble navigating all these complicated. I mean, I look at a credit thing and I see that fine print. I just don't want to deal with it. But you have no trouble navigating through it.
Right now, no trouble. But I learn a lot. So now I can look, all it takes is one screenshot and I know everything. And you might look at that same exact screenshot, you'd be like, this tells me absolutely nothing. And I get
that's what I would tell you.
Yeah. And I can run down your whole life story off that one screenshot. But, you know, I like to learn. So when you see me in the barbershop and I got my headphones on, I'm not listening to music. I don't listen to music at all. I'm not listening to J. Cole. I'm listening to something about real estate. I'm listening to something about credit. I might be listening to a sermon. I'm listening to anything that can educate me. Something about mental health, something about self-improvement. I'm always learning. So, and it's not like when I'm learning, I'm thinking, oh, I can't wait to listen to this song. Oh, I can't wait to stop doing it like it's homework or something. I actually enjoy learning. Hmm. So I don't have a problem with learning anything. I taught myself about taxes, taught myself about real estate, taught myself about credit. And I want to start flipping houses soon. And I'm going to teach myself about that.
Did you teach yourself barbering through YouTube
I'm
as
happy
well?
You, That's yes, right, I'm happy. I'm happy you said that. So, yep, never stepped foot in a barber school. Taught myself how to barber off of YouTube.
Yep. And you're doing pretty well with that.
Yep, doing pretty well with that. I own vending machines, taught myself about that. Like, I just love to learn and I love to apply and I love to be the example. You know, when my community see me doing stuff, like a lot of people could preach and I like to say don't be woke and broke. Because you woke and you preaching and everybody see you living a bad lifestyle. I like to be woke and make a little bit of money and show people, hey, you know, a lot of people say, oh, I want a vending machine, but never actually go get it. Well, right. I'm going to go get the vending machine, show you how to use it, show you how to use your credit to pay for stuff, show you how to do the tax write-offs. You know, I'll be very strategic with everything I do and show people like, hey, if you just educate yourself, you can do all this stuff you see me doing.
Okay, so now what's available then for people who might want to access your expertise here?
So I have a credit cheat code. I charge $100 for the credit cheat code, and it's really basically just to get you the foundation. Some people see a score increase of 100 to 150 points within the first month, depending on how your profile set up. But everybody would definitely see an increase. I say I could guarantee you at least 100 points in 6 months.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's pretty good.
Yeah,
that's pretty
for
good.
Sure.
So what's the best way to get a hold of you?
You can contact me on Facebook, Justin Juju Hawkins, or Instagram at Street Credit Juju, and TikTok at Street Credit Juju as well.
Yeah. And yeah. Are you in demand these days? I bet
oh,
you are.
Oh, yeah. I'm in high demand. I'm always moving around.
No sleep for you.
Nah.
Well, Justin Hawkins, I appreciate you coming in and talking to us.
All right. Thank you for having me, Jay.
Justin Hawkins with us on What's Next. This is What's Next on WBFO.
Stay with us. There's more to come. This is What's Next on WBFO.
Corey here with Compact Philosophy. Compact Civics. That little Freudian slip was because this episode finds us at a crossroads of civics and philosophy. Civic duties, rights, and responsibilities are often used interchangeably, but there are key differences. Let's philosophize. Civic duties are the legal and obligatory actions that citizens must fulfill as members of a community, like obeying laws, paying taxes, and serving on juries. They're basic requirements for maintaining a democratic society, but they're compulsory. Civic responsibilities are ethical expectations citizens have to participate in society and its well-being. Volunteering, community activism, and the common good are all examples of this. It's actively engaging in efforts to improve society. What about voting? Voting is a civil right that protects individuals aiming to ensure equality and prevent discrimination. And it's one of our constitutional civic rights, which allows for participation in a democratic society. And most importantly, because of the other points, voting is our civic responsibility, which is why you should go do it. These civic functions are essential for our democracy, as they ensure that we all have a voice in what makes our society thrive.
Special thanks to our partners, the Buffalo Presidential Center, whose mission is to explore and share stories about Buffalo and Western New York's contributions to the U.S. presidency and national affairs.
We at Buffalo Toronto Public Media take pride in bringing you your favorite national programs like Fresh Air, All Things Considered, and Morning Edition. But what makes WBFO so special are its local programs, learning together about how government works in bite-sized pieces on Compact Civics with host Corey McCamps.
Here's a quick guide on polling locations. A polling place is where you cast your ballot during elections. In America, the term polling place refers to the building, while polling station refers to the specific room or area where voting happens.
And diving into pop culture and local happenings on Group Chat with host Bentley and a revolving panel of friends in the know.
I really miss having to actually wait to tune in for a show and be there at the certain time. Like having to run home and like turn on the TV at a certain time to like watch your show.
Yeah. Like more national unity then too.
Yes.
Like we're all
turned in. Everybody is watching at the same time and you can like call and
ever
say,
since
did you see
streaming has just gone downhill.
This is Public Media.
You're listening to What's Next, our place to discuss the important issues of our communities of Western New York and Southern Ontario. We want to hear from you. Click on the Talk to Us option in the WBFO app, and we will work to get your questions or comments on the air. Have a story or concern that we should be addressing? Email us using whatsnext@wbfo.org. Together, we'll have the conversations that are needed. This is WBFO, your NPR station.
Welcome back to What's Next on WBFO. My name is Alex Simone, and for our next segment, I sat down with Kia Clark, the CEO of WNBA's New York Liberty. Clark is a 2003 alumna of Canisius University and will be keynote speaker in the upcoming Women's Leadership Summit hosted by the school this coming Friday. I caught up with her to discuss her journey from what was then Canisius College to the main stage of professional women's sports, as well as her excitement for the future of the WNBA.
Being a 2003 graduate and a member of the basketball team in that time, what's the opportunity, right? The being part of the leadership summit, right? What is the importance of this and what's that really signify to you?
Yeah, it's, having spent my entire career in professional women's sports, an opportunity to come back to campus, to be a part of the leadership summit, is at the core of everything that I have been and what I think I represent, just in terms of being affected by a really strong network of women. It's been a transformational point, you know, in my life. And I think it's not just about being in that space with women, with the women who will attend the event, but it's a place where I hope and intend that we're going to actively build each other up, right? I'll be with the women with the cohort all day. We'll spend time, but this is actually the genesis of a place where I too was encouraged to grow and keep growing. And I think, you know, from everything that I've learned about the summit, that's what it represents, a spirit of collaboration. It amplifies women's voices, and it's about joining together on the journey to support each other.
Along those lines of a strong network, what's it like knowing that this is, I mean, it's all Canisius grads. It's all alumni who are also, like fellow, I guess, yeah, fellow graduates, and you have CEOs, you have judges, you have, I mean, I think off the top of my head, you're one of two CEOs being featured in this, and what's it feel like just knowing that the student base or like the family of former students is like that strong at a local Jesuit college?
Yeah, there's something special about Canisius, and this opportunity I couldn't have imagined, right? When I think back, I hate that I've been pondering this math in preparation for next week, but to think that it was 25 years ago, probably 26 if you add my official visit, which is the first time I ever stepped on campus. But you know, as a student, I couldn't have imagined that I would be coming back as a CEO, as a WNBA champion, no less, for the New York Liberty. And you know, I think it'll probably be a bit surreal to be around current students and former students who have this common thread of, you know, we've walked Main Street, we've been in the tunnels. We have that commonality of what a Jesuit education and what Canisius and what it means to be a Golden Griffin. So there's a great deal of pride that comes along with that. And no matter where your journey takes you, to come back home, if you will, always is a great feeling. So I'm extremely excited to return back to Buffalo.
And I really want to make sure I mention too and ask your thoughts on in some of your previous I guess public appearances, you've talked about use your brain and not your hands to earn a living.
That is, I can riff on that, absolutely, and that is the God's honest truth.
And you said, Graham, I'm doing it just like you told me to.
Just like she told me to. Yes, 100%. So, to expound a little bit, I was raised in a household with my mom and both my grandparents, my mother's parents. And both of my grandparents were first sharecroppers in the South who moved north and took factory jobs. They were industrial workers. My grandmother worked as a machine operator for nearly the entirety of her career while also raising five children. And then a bonus child, which was me, the first grandchild. Oftentimes throughout my upbringing, she noted how, because she didn't have the opportunity to pursue education, not even through high school, that she was very much going to encourage me to pursue academia, but also to pursue a career in which I didn't have to use my hands every day through hard labor. She suffered from carpal tunnel near the end of her life, to the point where she actually, had trouble holding one of my little cousins. Like, you know, she had a new grandkid and she couldn't even hold them. So she'd always sort of drill into me to use my brain and use, you know, other skills besides labor with your hands. And playing basketball, obviously, you use your hands. But I was so fortunate to have an opportunity to use the game to propel me forward. So when I say or said in that quote, you know, Graham, I'm doing it, you know, I've made a living really in pursuit of elevating and amplifying women's voices and their lives and their stories and their athletic prowess. But, you know, I write emails, but I don't have to do piecemeal labor. So really, that was the sentiment that, you know, education could take me far. In other words, being more cerebral than manual would help me along the way.
And was she was she able to see you pursue your multiple degrees as well, you know, into the master's program? And
yeah,
that
yeah. My grandmother was at my Canisius graduation. That's the last graduation she attended. She passed away 2 months before I finished my master's at NYU.
What was it like to have that experience? Like, not just, okay, I'm going for an undergraduate degree isn't the end for me, right? I want to keep this going. And then especially to be at NYU, and that's so close to home for you, being Connecticut, right? And to sort of have that close to home and, you know, her seeing you go through that process for a second, you know, for an enhanced degree even.
Yeah. You know, Alex, I'm the first person in my family, my immediate family as such, or even my entire family in Connecticut, who has an advanced degree, who has a master's degree. And my grandmother was with me throughout most of those studies. I mentioned she passed away just before graduation, and she actually fell ill. And I, to your point, was close enough to home that I went home every single weekend to see her while I was in grad school. So I worked full-time at Condé Nast. I went to school full-time at night, and every Friday I'd get on the train and go home and spend time with her. So she saw me through the rigor of that degree and knew that it was something I was really inspired to do, sort of hinged on her words to, you know, utilize academics to propel me forward. So when I say I'm doing it, I truly believe she sees me. You know, she's looking down from above.
And how about that transition from being a player to then using, I'm sure using that experience in your current role as a CEO and you know, as a sort of a leader of a major brand.
Yeah. There's not a day that goes by, you know, that I don't draw a parallel to my life as a student athlete that equates to my life as a leader of a basketball team. You know, I don't think it's hyperbole to say, you know, when you work in sports, and oftentimes women leaders in sports were athletes, right? There's no question that the skills that you learn, the obstacles that you overcome directly attribute to playing the sport. When I think about being at Canisius and juggling academics and athletics, road trips and writing papers, practice and classes, that teaches you a level of organization, compartmentalization, sort of just, you know, school's over, door has shut, balls are bouncing, but mostly self-discipline. And I take that with me every single day. It's just sort of indoctrinated. It's been a part of my life for so long that it's just sort of who I am. I think similarly, this notion or the notion of resilience, losing games, and you can look up our record. We had a decent showing over my 4 years, but we by no means were, you know, dominating the MAC or, you know, going far in the MAC tournament. We did not make an NCAA tournament. You dream of those things when you become a collegiate athlete. And if those never happen, then it becomes, how do you move on? How do you bounce back? How do you overcome that? And I don't think enough could be said about camaraderie. I'm still incredibly close to the women I lived with, who were my roommates and my teammates during my time at Canisius. You know, there's this sisterhood of the people who, you know, I was closest to, and there's a sisterhood of the people I may have played 1 year with. But, you know, those are the folks who shot me a note when the Liberty won the championship. Those are the first calls I got when we lost in the finals in 2023, that's the bond that can't be broken. And that's ultimately what you're trying to create in the corporate space and in a leadership role in terms of what I do now. Sort of a long-winded answer, but suffice to say, I learned really early on during, those first months at Canisius that, if you really want to go anywhere worthwhile, you need to build a team in order to do it. And I feel that, that was instilled in me on that campus, and it's something that's been a through line for the entirety of my life and my career.
Now, one of the interesting things about it, kind of along the lines of what you say, it wasn't just the team part, though, I feel like it was also the like experience of, I mean, you didn't start out as like somebody in the upper offices, right? I mean, you started out in the like ticketing, I don't want to say ticketing, but in like marketing and in ticket sales, and to work your way up from that, and to have a very different, what sounds like a different sort of view of things, right? The marketing stuff, as opposed to like the day-to-day business dealings as CEO, right? How do those how do Maybe how important was that experience, or how are those different? What was that transition like?
Yeah, again, not unlike the evolution of an athlete, playing different positions, playing at different levels, learning new skills, gaining better skills year over year. That's always the approach I've taken to my career journey as well. As I began selling tickets at a sports museum. My first job was at the Basketball Hall of Fame, and sort of taking those pieces of what I could learn about corporate infrastructure, what I could learn about the origins of the game of basketball, and moving on to sort of transferring those skills into a role at the NBA WNBA League office. All along the way, you're picking up bits and pieces of the things that you excel at, dropping the things that you may be weaker at or weaknesses, or getting better at your weaknesses. It all depends. But that evolution, that career growth, I just so happen to, it's rare that one does that at one company or within one industry vertical. But I've happened to spend almost 20 years, just shy of 20 years in the WNBA. And I count it definitely an attribute to, my desire to want to contribute solutions in a really meaningful way to this league that I always believed had incredible potential to be mainstream, to be successful, to generate revenue, to have millions of fans. And super happy to be having this conversation right now and mention that sentence, because it's not something that I could have had proof of, 10 years ago, but I think we all sort of see where women's sports at the professional level have evolved and sort of what's next. I'm super excited about.
Along the lines of going mainstream, right, with the WNBA, like you said, and of course, being Women's History Month, what do you think it is that's maybe different about the WNBA over recent years on the whole, as opposed to like why it's at its most popular maybe since the 90s, right? As opposed to like when Maya Moore was playing, when Brittney Griner was starting her career, maybe why do you think it's able to be more successful as in terms of like media popularity than it was back then?
Yeah. There's actually a laundry list of reasons that I've actually pondered, especially over the last 2 years. As I mentioned, I've done this for a fairly long amount of time, but I often actually go back to the WNBA in particular was ahead of its time. Was the world ready to accept women achieving and excelling at a super high level, potentially at the expense of mind share for men's sports? And I ask it and I pose it as a question: Was the world ready 15 years ago? Was it ready 10 years ago? And I think, and I'll name a few of those laundry lists of things that have contributed to this momentum. One being media coverage, and thank you for this interview and, you know, shining light on someone who works in women's sports. But media coverage was often or is often controlled by who's telling the story. Social media allows for people to tell their own stories, the athletes, the brands, the teams, the leagues. So it gave us a platform. Social media gives us a platform to actually showcase and elevate what exactly this product is. So that's one. Two, you mentioned Maya Moore, you mentioned Brittany Griner. We thought the surge in the WNBA, at least I thought, was going to happen during those moments as well. I can talk about that era. I could talk about, you know, Brittany was with Skylar and Elena Deladon. You have the Maya Moore time. You have the Candace Parker time. We thought that the trigger point was going to happen in those moments. It just so happens that it happened with this last rookie class where you have, you know, the incredibly exciting Final Four of, including or NCAAs with Angel Reese and Caitlin Clark. There's no doubt in my mind that those athletes entering the WNBA, and not just those two, but there were several in that class, Rekia Jackson and Cameron Brink, the excitement at the collegiate level for the first time completely transferred and crossed over to the pros. So I would count that as a second. Third, I don't want to downplay at all the pioneers and the foundation layers and the people who have been working at this for a really long time, myself included. You know, the Liberty specifically, our recent growth is really a product of a five-year strategic plan that we put together, during the pandemic, where we were poised to be at this moment. And we got an extra jolt from some of those other factors that I just mentioned. But, you know, it's not just one thing, I guess, is what I'm saying, Alex. It's many things coming together. But also, I can't ignore the fact that what women's sports represents in terms of equality, or dare I say equity, the intersection between women, women of color, people in the LGBTQ plus community, at a time when these diverse identities are threatened, women's sports represents what's possible. When you put all that aside and everybody in our arena is cheering for their team and it's the most inclusive environment you'll ever be in, that's needed right now. So I think in a lot of ways, we're a solution to what is really challenging times overall.
And to kind of bring it back full circle for my last question, as far as the, again, just having all of these people from over the years, right? I think names I've seen listed have gone back really 50 years, right? Back to the 70s. And just being able to see all of your fellow, fellow women leaders, right? And what's that anticipation like, right? Where are you like, is it like a butterflies in the stomach thing? Is it like, and especially to be the keynote, the one kicking it all off, like, yeah, what's that anticipation like? What's that, mindset?
Yeah, I'm actually just super excited. No butterflies here, Alex. As I mentioned, some of the most special years of my life occurred during those 4 years at Canisius. And I'm enamored to return to Buffalo. I have been back a few times, but not for this many days. I've only seen a few games. I'll get to see two women's games while I'm there. My family is going to join me in Buffalo, and we're going to eat wings, and we're going to, do the touristy things that you do in Buffalo, because my kids haven't seen campus before. So for me, this is pure excitement. No butterflies. I'm looking forward to great conversations. I'm looking forward to meeting new faces. I don't know how many folks I will know actually in the room, just because I've been away for 20 plus years. But even the relationships that have grown over time, particularly with This current women's Canisius team. I've seen them play a few times this season. Coach Tiffany Swafford has come to some Liberty games, and you know, there's a women's basketball group chat that I'm a part of with, you know, women from all different years. I hope some of them are there, but it really feels like a homecoming, a reunion of sorts. No jitters, no nervousness. I do speaking engagements for a living, so I feel really good about this one. It feels familial, I guess is the adjective that I would use.
That was Kia Clark, the CEO of the WNBA's New York Liberty. Thank you for listening to What's Next on WBFO.
Support for WBFO and What's Next comes from our members and from Health Foundation for Western and Central New York, where racial and socioeconomic health equity are prioritized. Learn more about building healthier neighborhoods at hfwcny.org.